One more? Do we need one more? No.
No. Oh, no. Okay,
I'm good.
Sorry.
Hey, my eyes go both ways. Good afternoon. I'm opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is May 22nd, 2017. It's a public hearing on House Bill 5015, Department of Justice. And I see the Attorney General is here just waiting to come up.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And I know, is Mr. Voss coming up with you as well?
He'll be right after me.
Part two.
Okay.
No, I need you. I need you next to me.
Thank you, Coach.
Thank you.
And just for the record, the good Senator Steiner Haywood is back in I believe she's in Boston.
Yes.
Because her daughter is graduating from college, and so proud mother is back for all the ceremonies. So.
Well, Co-Chair Winters, if I could go on the record congratulating Senator Steiner Haywood and her family. Wonderful. It is that time of year. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Winters and Stark and members of the subcommittee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum, Oregon Attorney General, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to continue our discussions on the budget for the Oregon Department of Justice and to start by reminding you of DOJ's priorities as I see them. Our mission is to provide essential justice services to state government in order to support safe and healthy communities throughout Oregon. We are proud to be the state's lawyers. It's our role to uphold the rule of law, safeguard consumers from fraud and unfair business practices, protect the environment, protect children and look out for families, supervise charities, fight crime, advocate for crime victims, provide state agencies with quality legal advice and representation, handle the state's appeals, and much more. As you know, in addition to our budget, we have been very busy with several key policy initiatives. I have been honored to chair two task forces, one on law enforcement profiling and another on public records law reform, both of which are bringing forward important proposals this session. I also want to thank you for supporting our new elder abuse unit, which is now up and running and already demonstrating results. In addition to these priorities, I support the governor's and the task force on representation in childhood dependencies efforts to expand legal representation for DHS caseworkers. I also want to emphasize the importance of preserving funding for crime victims through our Crime Victim Services Division and the funding of legal efforts to protect Oregonians from consumer fraud. Finally, our legal divisions are essential in protecting state resources by defending the state in lawsuits brought against it. For your convenience, we have included a slide of the department's mission and values, which is, I think, slide three. There's the mission and values. And a high-level slide of our organizational chart, which I think is the one you just saw up there, slide four. Slide five. Now I will introduce the topics of our presentations for today and tomorrow. We will explain the DOJ hourly billing rate, some of the functions of the Criminal Justice Division, how our General Counsel Division reviews contracts for state agencies, how our Division of Child Support collects child support payments due to families. We will also explain our key performance measures, our budget reduction options, our policy packages and needed adjustments, and pending legislation that affects the DOJ budget. And I think we're going to go over a couple of days to do all of that. Our first presentation is on the DOJ hourly billing rate. My Deputy Attorney General Fred Boss and our Chief Financial Officer Art Ayer will now present that information. Would you like to have me switch with Art? With your permission, I'll have Mr. Ayer switch seats with
Good.
Me. Thank you.
Co-chairs Winters and Stark, members of the subcommittee, my name is Fred Boss. With me is Art Ayer, I'm the Deputy Attorney General. With me is Art Ayer, our Chief Financial Officer. Together we will explain how we calculate the use of the DOJ hourly billing rate. Here is a list of the questions that we will address in our presentation. Two statutes give DOJ the authority to charge agencies for our legal services. For brevity, we have summarized the authorities provided in each of the statutes. I do want to point out that the statute does not directly establish a billing rate, but instead that rate is developed as part of the budgetary process, and it changes from biennium to biennium. Seven of our nine divisions are funded partly or wholly by our legal billings. These are the divisions listed at the top of the slide, and we've called them legal divisions here, and that's more of a term we're using, that they are supported by our legal fund as opposed to federal funds or other types of funds. Those that we call non-legal divisions are actually supported by monies other than our legal fund, such as general fund, grants, judgments, and collections. When we bill for our legal services, the payment for those services go into our legal fund. This fund then pays the expenses of the various legal divisions. Slide 10 here is how we develop or how we bill our state agency clients. The clients come to us with a legal question, or they have a problem and they want to sue somebody, a whole variety of legal issues. They work with the attorney. The attorney does work. The attorney captures the work that he does in a billing system. We create a invoice. That invoice is sent to the client, and then the client pays within 30 days. We do have a key performance measure on the payment within 30 days. You can see here that we've been fairly consistent at 88% of our invoices being paid within 30 days. This is actually not a problem now. About 15 years ago, this was a tremendous problem for us. We had certain clients that were waiting a year to pay us, and we had some cash flow crises. So we instituted this KPM.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Reverend Huffman.
And I'm sorry, Fred, I should have caught you before, because it's not on this slide, but I'm sitting here thinking, we all frequently read in the headlines about a state agency that has had a hiccup. You know, oftentimes it's DHS or whatever. And I'm always asking myself, how did Acme Agency let this happen when they have ready access to DOJ? Do you guys scratch your head and wonder that the same thing sometimes about, man, if they had just picked up the phone and called us ahead of it, how does that relationship work? And do you often have those times when you wish a client would have called you sooner than later, before the headlines hit? How do you encourage them to do that? How does that process work?
Co-chairs Winters and Stark, Representative Huffman, wonderful question, and it's something that puzzles us all the time. Yes, we wish that we could get in there early with a little bit of corrective action. There are many problems we could solve, not all of them, but very, very many. And towards the end of this presentation, we will talk about a different billing system that we are experimenting with, and we hope to maybe move towards in the next biennium. This billing system, the hourly billing system, sometimes can have a disincentive to give us a call, in that the client has to pay $100, or I forget, $175 an hour for our advice. And some clients, unfortunately, want to save that $175, but they end up paying 10 or 20 times or 100 times that down the way when they just go it on their own without legal advice. We believe that there might be a different model in which there is no disincentive to call us early. In fact, there might be an incentive to call us early and say that you won't be saving that money. So we're going to talk about it at the end. We mull on that all the time. How do we get these people to call us? Another thing that we do is the public law conference that we've just initiated after kind of a hiatus for a while. We want to get information out there to our client agencies so they know the general framework of the law and then feel they can ask us intelligent questions and perhaps save some money because they have gone from A to C, and then they're just asking the last part of it. So,
okay, great.
Yeah, it's a constant struggle for us. So this is good. These are our external clients. We cannot serve the general public. We have a very, under Chapter 180, we have a limited pool of people that we represent, state officers and agencies, which includes the three branches of the government. And these are our external clients. We bill them in that billing model that we just saw. We also have internal programs, and we bill them the very same way. And in fact, I believe there are some federal requirements that we have to treat our internal clients the same as our external clients. So we have defense of criminal convictions, consumer protection. We have internal funding sources, but we bill, we produce an invoice, and that invoice is paid, and it is paid into the legal fund. This now gets to what the question that Representative Huffman was asking about. How can we encourage our clients to contact us earlier and get ahead of the curve on some of these problems? We have been experimenting with what we call an alternative billing model. Actually, it's a flat fee model. So we take, rather than having a billable hour where we do the work, we write it down, send them an invoice, and then they pay us, we take the cost for the agency over a biennium, have a flat fee, divided up into eighths. It's a projected cost. They work that into a client agency works it into their budget. It's worked into our budget. And then they can use our services as much as they want. Now, there is a caveat on that in that we only have a finite amount of attorneys, so we can't do everything in the world. But this, we hope, will encourage them to call us ahead of time. Wow, I think there's a problem. Let me see if it's really a problem. I'll call my lawyer. And we can get ahead of the curve and start dealing with these instead of having them fester and then being called in, essentially risk being called in to take care of the problem. So here's, we currently have 19 participants. We've been working over the last couple biennial putting together an experiment. We have part of DHS, the child welfare portion. We hope to do this upcoming biennium. We are talking with other bigger clients this upcoming biennium. I believe the Department of Corrections and some others. We hope to have enough of a track record in place that we can, for the 19-21 biennium, really start putting this together and see if it will work.
Just a point of clarity, because of the question that was raised by Rep. Huffman in talking about the flat rate, and I know that you're working with DOC and DHS, and he mentioned DHS, and just for clarity, and so we put some context around it so that individuals don't think that some of the things that you hear of the agency, I do not believe that they're talking about down at the level of, you know, they field questions, everything from clarity from what's happening with their relationship with the federal government and rules that come in to whether or not the regulations that they're putting in place and all that. So there's a lot of interaction between the Department of Justice and these particular agencies, particularly. On the DOC side, it is everything from individuals in appeals work, or you name it. I suspect that there's probably something coming in from them daily, maybe multiple things coming in from them daily. So I just have to put some context around it. I don't think that they're talking casework practice, by the way, but they're actually talking about rules and regulations and stuff that impact casework.
Yes, Senator Winters. This is... shows how it works. We just calculate over a period of time and have a flat model. So far, we believe this works for us and for the client agencies and most of our agencies. In fact, I believe all of them that have participated in this experiment are happy. I will now turn this over to, if there are any questions, I can be happy to answer some or later. I'd like to turn it over to Art.
Thank you, Fred. Good afternoon, co-chairs Winters and Stark. My name is Art Ayer. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Department of Justice. And this section of the presentation will explain in fairly general terms, high-level terms, how we determine the hourly billing rate for legal services. So this is a simple mathematical representation of it. We have at the top projected total costs of providing legal services divided by the projected number of billable hours. The result is an hourly rate. Now, how we get there is a little complicated, but the overall formula is fairly simple. The projected costs are controlled by the budget, so the budget effectively sets the billing rate. About 4/5 of the total costs are personal services costs, salaries and wages plus benefits and other payroll expenses. The projected total cost is affected by things such as cost of living adjustments, the addition or subtraction of positions, and a working capital adjustment that assures an adequate working capital and ending balance in the legal fund. The projected number of billable hours is also affected as we develop the budget, affected by things such as the number of authorized positions that we start with, and then changes to that number of authorized positions, and the type of positions that are changing, such as adding billers or adding non-billers. So we'll talk a little bit more of that as we go forward. This slide shows the variety of billers and their rates. We have 6 billing rates. The most common rate is the one that's used by attorneys, and you can see several different types of attorneys: honors attorneys, regular attorneys, attorneys in charge, essentially supervising attorneys. And then other types of positions such as investigators, paralegals, law clerks, and clerical. And then we have what's an acronym there I'll explain at the bottom. ADR coordinator is our alternative dispute resolution coordinator. There's a single position there, somebody who attempts to find the most appropriate way to resolve a legal dispute and the least costly and most appropriate. The most common rate used is the attorney rate. Up at the top, the $175 per hour in this biennium, and obviously that group has the most positions and therefore bills the largest number of hours. So I think that's all that I wanted to do with that. This slide shows some of the major driving cost factors that affect the hourly billing rate. Obviously, direct costs within the legal divisions, their salaries and benefits, their services and supplies paid directly for what they purchase directly out of their budgets. And then a tiny bit of capital outlay, so I included it, but it's very de minimis. And then central service costs. These are internal to DOJ, but they're within our administrative services division. And the legal divisions, like the other non-legal divisions, pay for that administrative services cost through an indirect rate or an intra-agency charge. In other words, it comes out of the legal division's budgets, goes into the administrative services budget. And technically, we call administrative services part of the legal division, so there's a little overlap, you might say, there, but essentially all of the legal divisions are supporting the administrative services division, a portion of the administrative services division. Then there are the non-legal divisions, which also support a portion of the administrative services division. And then finally, there are external costs. These are costs such as state government service charges. These and the central service costs all show up in services and supplies in the legal division's budgets. But we're breaking them out here just to clarify some interesting pieces within that services and supplies category. So those are some ways of itemizing the various costs that affect the hourly billing rate within the legal divisions. As I mentioned, about 80%, about $4 out of $5 spent in the legal divisions is spent on personal services. And this slide shows the current biennium average salary in the legislatively adopted budget for senior assistant attorney generals and assistant attorneys general. And then the governor's budget figures for 2017-19, and you can see an 11.2% increase for seniors and 11.5% increase for assistant attorney general. Those incorporate a number of changes that took place in the current biennium, including two cost of living adjustments, various selective market adjustments, such as a new top step for assistant attorney generals, a 4.5% salary increase effective June 1st of 2016, and a new top step for senior assistant attorneys general. The next slide shows, again, that 80% or roughly 80% of total costs in the legal divisions for personal services. And that dollar value increased about 10.6% between the legislatively approved budget for the current biennium and the current services level budget for the 2017-19 biennium. And you can see on that one, if you go back, the very, very small special payments and capital. Actually, special payments is zero. Capital outlay is, I believe, right around $400,000, so very small capital outlay there. Going to the next slide. That's it. Thank you. This shows, again, a little bit more detail as to how we get to the billing rate. We start with the current biennium's legislatively adopted budget, move that forward to the legislatively approved budget, which incorporates the various changes in the short session and the emergency boards, and then add adjustments for the next biennium, including cost of living adjustment, the changes to benefits, if any, PERS rates, costs, base adjustments, essential packages, inflation, that type of thing. And then finally adjust for policy packages, and that, of course, is where a lot of the potential variable comes from. And then a working capital adjustment, again, to give us a sufficient ending balance and working capital in the legal fund. Those adjustments to the 2015-17 budget bring us up to a projected 2017-19 expenditure, and then by dividing that expenditure by the projected billable hours, we get a billable hour rate. The projected billable hours is also a little bit variable, as I mentioned earlier, and that can be variable based on which policy option packages are approved, because a policy option package may add positions that bill, and therefore that increases the projected number of billable hours that we have, and that tends to drive down rate, unless that addition also incorporates costs that equal or exceed the additional revenue generated by those additional hours of billing. So I know I went through that rather quickly, and it's a little convoluted, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to field them at this point, or I'll move along to the next conundrum. All right. This is a question that comes up occasionally, and so we wanted to address it. How can adding lawyers reduce the hourly rate for legal services? It goes back to the equation that is used to develop the hourly rate. It has a numerator and a denominator, and if a change increases the number of billable hours by more than the cost in the numerator, then the rate can actually decline. So if we add more billers than we add associated costs, that essentially generates more revenue than those costs, and it drives the hourly rate down. Because we're not trying to create a profit with the rate. We're simply trying to break even with the costs that we have and the adjustment to our working capital that will allow us to go into the next biennium with a sufficient ending balance. A typical policy package that would do that is the mandated caseload package, where it isn't uncommon, in fact, it's fairly common, to add attorneys but not add substantial other costs. And so typically what happens there is we are adding more billing capability than we are adding costs. So we wind up generating more revenue through that mandated caseload package than the associated costs to the agency, and that brings rates down a little bit, typically. So let's go on to the next one. In our agency request budget, this was developed back in the early part of 2016, we didn't know at that point, we still don't know, what policy option packages will be part of our budget, but we put in a placeholder for that and a variety of other assumptions that we had available to us at the time, and we came up with a billing rate, an hourly billing rate of $198 per hour for the next biennium. That was used by all agencies who had attorney general budgets, in their or attorney general account lines in their budget, and so whatever the final rate becomes, those other agencies will have an adjustment to their budget to represent that change between the $198 an hour figure that they used originally and what ultimately becomes the hourly rate. When those other agencies pay our bills, some of what they use to pay is general fund. According to figures that I received recently from the Department of Administrative Services, in the 2017-19 current service level budgets, about 41% of the attorney general line budget for all agencies is general fund. So when we bill those agencies and they pay us, roughly in the neighborhood of 41% is likely to be general fund. And one more. This slide compares our current biennium rate, particularly the $175 per hour attorney general rate, with the rates that we put into our agency request budget. And again, $198 an hour was the attorney rate in our agency request budget. And then finally, looking at the private sector and comparing our figures to the private sector, the most recent we have for the private sector is a May 2012 survey from the Oregon State Bar of its members that showed the average private practice billing rate in 2012. And obviously this was a survey done in early 2012, but in and around that time frame was $242 per hour. And back in around that time frame, our hourly billing rate for attorneys was $143 per hour.
Question.
Yes.
On those rates, private versus mm-hmm. public, was those rates for the private, did that include all the benefits as well?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I believe... I believe this was the straight billing rate that that the private sector charged their clients. Now, of course, there were a number of ways that the
profit margins and all that.
There were a variety of things that were built into that. Certainly, I don't remember the discussion about where that money went, but this was the actual rate that they were charging. And there was actually a considerable range depending on geographic location. They had probably 6 or 8 regions around the state broken out. They had different specialties. They had different durations of practice, someone who's new to the practice versus been in the practice for 30 years, that type of thing. But this was the average.
Who's next?
If there are no further questions, we'll bring up our next speaker, who is Michael Slosson, to talk about the Criminal Justice Division.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the subcommittee, my name is Michael Slosson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice. I currently serve as Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. And I'm happy to be back here testifying before you again this afternoon. And today I'll be specifically talking about the work we perform in the Criminal Information Services section. I'm going to talk about the duties we perform as a designated fusion center for the state of Oregon and the duties that we perform through the HIDA program. I'll start with the duties we perform as the Titan Fusion Center. We are one of 78 fusion centers across the country. We were designated on April 4th of 2011 by former Governor Kitzhaber as Oregon's Fusion Center. With that designation, when it's recognized by the Department of Homeland Security, comes with it certain responsibilities that I'll discuss and resources that the Department of Homeland Security provides to Oregon. The Fusion Center network was created in response to September 11th, and it's basically a recognition of how critical it is that we share information with our law enforcement partners and our private partners. And essentially what you do not want to have and what they recognize in that particular event is you had silos of information. They want to make sure that if somebody has a piece of the puzzle, that they're sharing that information with other people who might have other parts of that puzzle. You can see here that the fusion centers are unique in design, but the main functions are the same, and it's information sharing among our public and private partners to ferret out crime and terrorism. Most of the fusion centers located across the country are in law enforcement agencies. Most of them are law enforcement specific, as is the Oregon Department of Justice. You see 3% are in emergency management, but again, most of them are in law enforcement sections with designated sections. I thought it might be helpful to explain briefly the difference between the JTTF and the fusion center, kind of the different functionality. The fusion center, the main purpose of having the designation of a fusion center is to share information and get information in the hands of the people that can use it. And that's what we are. We are a hub. The example I use, if you've read the book Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, how a trend becomes nationwide popular. I think it started out with the hush puppy shoes is what it talked about in the book. How does that become so popular? You need connectors. You need somebody who's going to get the information and other people and really spread the word. And that's what the fusion center does. That's our role. We work on all crimes and all hazards, so we're talking about, when we get through that, we start talking about our critical information, our critical infrastructure program, natural disasters, crimes, terrorism, we cover it all. On the other hand, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, they're investigative based, so they're taking leads that we may generate for them, and they're actually going out and doing the investigations. Again, our job is to get it in the hands of the people that can take it and do something with it. That's our role. Is to share the information to people and bring it back and get it to the people who can use it. And for the JTTF, they need to have a terrorism nexus before they're going to be able to take action. So there, lots of situations in which we get information from some of our partners, it's not appropriate to send to the JTTF because it's not a terrorism nexus. So we might reach out to local sheriff, local PD's office, might do both, depending on who we know or who we think is going to be the best to handle that. So the staffing in the fusion center, we have three general funded FTE. They're limited duration positions currently, and we have two FTE that are provided by the Homeland Security Grant Fund. But that's just a small part of the fusion center. Of course, it's a network of our partners, both again private and public partners. So not just law enforcement. It could be people who own critical infrastructure throughout the state, because they have valuable information that we need to be able to have and to share. We do have, one of the benefits we have to being the designated fusion center for the state is that DHS provides us with one analyst who does threat assessments and information sharing, and we have another analyst who helps with critical infrastructure and identifying critical infrastructure in the state. And I'll talk about this a little bit later, but that's really important because the information that we can that we develop in Oregon and that when we identify critical infrastructures and we share that with the federal government, that brings resources to Oregon to help protect Oregonians and that critical infrastructure. So some of these other partners are not located full-time within the Fusion Center in our office, but they work with us closely. They're a phone call away. They are there sometimes on a part-time basis. So again, here as the slide indicates, we work with state and local law enforcement. Again, we stretch well beyond that, though, to public and private entities. Here are the programs that are performed by us. Our responsibilities as a designated fusion center, first and foremost, the primary function is information sharing. That's what we do, and you'll see that's a common theme throughout this presentation. Part of that information sharing initiative includes the Terrorism Liaison Officer Program. I'll touch base on that in a little bit. The Investigative Support Services was just something I talked about a little bit in the last presentation I did. The Urban Area Security Initiative, UASI. There's one thing you cannot do when you're talking about the Fusion Center, and that is avoid acronyms. whether that's the three-letter federal agencies or... you'll get a lot of them. So we have the Oregon Critical Infrastructure Program, which we'll also be talking about. So again, back to it, information sharing, one of the critical functions of the Fusion Center, which is part of our obligations through DHS, Department of Homeland Security. So daily alerts, those are missing persons, be on the lookout, attempts to locate. So this could be a local law enforcement officer is usually actually should back up. If we're talking about the Fusion Center, we're talking about our national network of partners. I'll get to the local when I get to the Watch Center. So we're talking about maybe somebody in Florida has a reason to think a kidnapped child is coming to Oregon. Maybe the person who did the kidnapping has some relatives in Oregon. So the first thing that they'll do, they know where to go. They know to go to the Fusion Center first. They don't have to try to find out which agency might be involved. Where's the address? Is that Tigard? Is that Tualatin? They can call the Fusion Center, and we do that work for them. Part of the main function of the Fusion Center is really to get the information to the people who need it and to reduce the friction in doing that. The last thing you want is to make it hard on people, because then they've got enough on their plate already. So if we can reduce that friction, and that's one of the key functions of having designated Fusion Centers across the state. So it's a one call, you're done, you got it. So we do a lot of that kind of stuff. And of course, we would take the same thing if we don't know where maybe somebody's going. So we might have, you could say it's a red Chevy and we have three letters of a license plate, and we'll send that out to the Fusion Centers. They send it out from the Fusion Centers out across the country. They send that out to their local partners, and then they're all looking. They see that flyer. Heck, I just pulled that guy over, or whatever it might be, and then they can go from there. We've got some examples of that. Send out information about officer safety. That's very critical. If there's it could be something where a flashlight has a hidden knife in it, other techniques that people are using. That is really a lot of what the Fusion Center does, is that kind of information. It's not a lot of, unless we're talking about the specific be on the lookouts or missing persons, we have specific people. A lot of times we're just sharing information about trends and things that we're seeing, so officers are aware of what to look for their safety. So a situational awareness, the same thing, maybe an upcoming event. You call up the Capitol and say, you have 300 people coming on Monday for this or that, FYI, because you might need extra support to address that. So, and we get that for various sources. So we work again here with our federal partners, DHS and the FBI. So the field analysis reports is information the FBI has identified about trends and tactics. So maybe they have some new information about bomb-making materials that we don't know about. So they can give that information to us. We can then ship that out and a message out to our law enforcement partners. They can see that information. Someone maybe during a traffic stop, they see something that otherwise would look totally innocuous. Now they see that. They might have a basis for a follow-up question or other investigation. So the industry notifications are notifications sent through us to our industry partners to identify different trends and threats that the FBI is aware of, or the Department of Homeland Security is aware about, so they can be better prepared. We share that with our vetted partners. And then the weekly bulletins we send out is information that we have received throughout the week, this general trend information from the various Fusion Centers across the country. And we combine that information and use information that was known to us. It really gives it an Oregon connection, so it's more relevant and pertinent to Oregon law enforcement officers. And then we send that out for their own situational awareness. And I've got a slide here coming up next that I think really epitomizes how important this program is. So you had a rape at the Port of Portland. What they had is they had a victim description, and they had a clip of a video that was difficult to discern who it was. That's it. That's what they had to go on. So the first place they turned to is the Fusion Centers. Can you help us identify who this person is? Can you do research? Can you send it out? What can you help us with? So we send it out, and as you see this, you see that the information goes out, and it goes out into Massachusetts, North Carolina, and Colorado. Detectives in those communities got the information from our Fusion Center to their Fusion Center, got that flyer, looked at it, were able to aid in that investigation to identify that person, and called back the Port of Portland. So what's so compelling about that example is that it helped resolve this important case and identifies somebody who had committed crimes in multiple states, but also shows that people really are invested across the country in this program, that they really do read the information they have and they respond, and how effective it can be when they do that. Beside the Terrorism Screening Center, this is What this function is that when the FBI has reasonable suspicion to believe that somebody is engaged in terrorist activities and believe that that person is located in Oregon, they reach out to us to aid in doing background information and helping them to develop their investigation. And the reason for that is because we have connections and access to sources that the FBI doesn't, and that's a real aid to them in doing those terrorism cases. And you can see from this slide that we have seen a significant uptick in the number of those requests and is projected to continue on that path throughout the year. Part of the Fusion Center also has what we call the Emergency Coordination Center. Again, this is back to that core function of information sharing. And so what this is both the Oregon Situation Awareness Room and the National Situation Awareness Room, is they're actually online. So you have a secure network provided by the Department of Homeland Security where people who are vetted partners can access that network and learn information about events. And why that can be critical is imagine you have something that's going across the country, maybe like a May Day or some sort of parade or something going on. When we log into this, we can see immediately if there's trends, something happened on the East Coast, so we can start preparing for it immediately on the West Coast if that were to happen, and we can share information. So we do that kind of thing when we're talking about the inauguration and things so that we know in advance what's going on from our other partners. This is Terrorism Liaison Officer Program. This is a critical component of our efforts to gather information. What we do is we do outreach to local law enforcement officers and do training to make them trained observers, share with them relevant information about trends in crimes, so that they can identify criminal activity that might not be able to identify without that training and experience. And then again, what we're doing is trying to reduce the friction. In the past, if officers are out in the field and identify something suspicious, there may not be something that they would know where to go. Somebody's taking a number of pictures at a dam. What does that mean? It's not a crime. I don't know where to send that information. They can send it to us. We'll identify. Sometimes it is crime. Sometimes it's not. But we will share that with the appropriate investigative agency, give feedback to the terrorism liaison officer so they know what happened, or distribute out the information. Hey, we're seeing a trend of people taking pictures of dams, just using that as a hypothetical. Have you seen it elsewhere? Maybe there's purchasing something that is, again, innocuous, but is part of a bomb-making material. So we start seeing like, oh, that's happening in Wasco County. Oh, it's happening to Deschutes County as well, and we start connecting those dots, get detectives together so we can see if there's any trends or patterns we need to identify. We also do investigative support services. This is part of the program I discussed last time. We do the informational charts, so that could be like link charts or timelines. So, you know, you think of the movies, one of those detective movies where they've got the different pictures on the wall and strings are tied together and they crack the case by looking at the different pictures and the connections. That's largely what we don't have it on a wall with string and pictures. It's all computerized now, but that's essentially what that type of analysis is drawing connections between individuals and entities. There's graphic visualizations, and what we're thinking about in that context is like demonstrative aids that would help people in understanding what the case is about. So when I was here last time, I showed a slide that we used to show cell phone activity where a suspect said he was in one location, his cell phone activity on his phone showed he's in another location. It's kind of stuff we can use in court and other presentations. So do financial analysis, other general evidence analysis, communications analysis. So we're talking about cell phone analysis, looking at different connections, who's calling who, that kind of thing, to put links together in for instance, like a drug trafficking organization. So do a lot of training and outreach to our partners to help them develop that skill. We have one analyst currently assigned to do that, so there's a lot more work than that across the state, so we work with other people to help them do that. Okay, the UASI program is a federally funded position that is housed at our office as a designated fusion center. So UASI, as you can see here, stands for the Urban Area Security Initiative, and this is one position, and this is kind of a jack-of-all-trades position. So this particular analyst works in the counties identified here, Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Columbia, and Clark. has to works on both disaster preparedness, works with agencies up in those metro areas on that. She does threat assessments, risk and vulnerability threat assessments. She works on cases. Her specialty is on human trafficking and financial crime. So she's working on foreign-born and domestic human trafficking and working with the U.S. Attorney's Office on those cases and other financial crimes. And you can see here, again, the partnership when we're talking about disaster preparedness, it's not just a public issue. It's a public and private issue. We bring everybody together at the table to discuss how we're best going to protect Oregon's critical assets.
Is this federally funded?
Chair Winters, members of the committee, yes, it is. That particular position is a federally funded position. So the critical infrastructure program, we have one analyst who supports this program on the state side. We do have another DHS analyst that I mentioned that is co-located at our office that also works on critical infrastructure. So she worked on and developed, which I have here, the Oregon State Infrastructure Protection Plan, which is signed by the Attorney General, Adjutant General, and the Governor, which sets forth the plan for the state of Oregon about how we are going to work together both with state and federal and local partners to protect the critical assets in Oregon. Part of the critical infrastructure program also performs threat assessments, which is usually it's surrounded by events. So it could be an air show or the Rose Parade or the Pendleton Roundup, and identifies threats associated with those events. We do vulnerability risk assessments. So those types of assessments would look at a structure and identify weaknesses in terms of natural
disasters. How vulnerable are we in the Capitol?
Senator Winters, members of the committee, we have done a threat assessment of the Capitol, but I don't have the specifics of it in front of me. I can get that back and share it with you.
I think that would be nice if you share it with members up here, how vulnerable the Capitol is.
So in terms of the risk and vulnerability assessment that we did at the Capitol, I do recall there are things like you need to lock the back door. There may be suggestions
The gate down in the basement.
Senator Winters, it could be the gate in the basement, but but yes. And so there was some issues in terms of the size of some bushes and trees that block windows and access. There are things like other security measures that could be employed here that would protect. There are recommendations that can help help minimize some of the vulnerabilities. We also do DHS data calls, and what that is that when we work with the Department of Homeland Security to, again, identify new critical infrastructure within the state or other events like the Rose Parade that may present risks, and doing those types of calls and identifying those new infrastructures helps bring federal dollars to the state to protect those infrastructures. So that's part of the work that we do, so we bring in more money into the state to help protect those. We also work on various work groups, so CIKR, again, the acronyms, that's just the critical infrastructure and key resources, the cybersecurity work groups. We do have actually not specifically in this particular unit, but we do have one of our special agents, one of our law enforcement officers that works on the FBI Cybercrime Task Force to help work and identify areas in which we're vulnerable in terms of cybersecurity. And I can tell you that largely that has to do with outreach and letting people know what the various risks are. That's largely what we work on doing. So HIDA, talk a little bit about the HIDA. I'll start with the Watch Center. The Watch Center has four full-time analysts that are funded through the HIDA program. One of their key functions is deconfliction. And so deconfliction is, talked a little bit about this the last time I was here, but if you have, say, for instance, a particular residence where law enforcement is going to do a search warrant or take some other action, call the Watch Center and let us know what the address is, what the location is, and so we can put that information down, and then we know if somebody else calls and says, hey, I'm going to do a search warrant at this house, well, you need to get in touch with this other agency because they're going to do the same thing. So they also do the same thing with subjects to make sure that if one agency is investigating a subject, that the other agency is aware of that as well. Another, in addition to deconfliction, do short-term, quick turnaround case support. It's research. We have really experienced and skilled analysts working in the watch center that have a lot of real good connections across the state that are really helpful in doing investigations. Once an officer has reasonable suspicion that somebody's engaged in criminal activity, they can contact our office and we can help provide background information for them. We can do other intelligence searches to help them develop their case, to see who they're connected with, part of the link chart analysis I'm talking about, maybe perhaps where they've lived in the past, if that's relevant to the investigation. That's the kind of work that they do. Also support the Domestic Highway Enforcement Program, which is a HIDA initiative. So this is we work partnership with the state police. So what this program is that when the state police come in contact with a stopped vehicle and they develop probable cause that there's contraband in that vehicle, drugs, or other evidence relating to drug trafficking activity, they reach out to us and we search various databases that are available to us to determine whether that person is known to other law enforcement agencies to be involved in any kind of drug trafficking conduct. So then that way we can connect up that officer out in the field with the other agency that's working that case. That's part of a HIDA initiative. So, and the Watch Center does that kind of work. Generally, it's kind of an example of the work they do. I can give you another example in which an agency had a homicide occurred in August of last year. They had a suspect and they had a vehicle, but they don't know where the suspect is. And so, again, one of the first places they come for information is to the Watch Center. Call the National Watch Center for help, and using various databases available to us, we could look in and see if any other agency had been looking for that particular vehicle or had contact with that vehicle. And sure enough, they did at the Seattle airport. So we were able to direct the detectives up to the Seattle airport and say, hey, your suspect was contacted yesterday at the Seattle airport, and reaching up to police out there, that's how they caught the suspect. So it's that kind of work that we do, is trying to find, get the information to people and really be that connector.
Can we go back to HIDA a little bit? Because things have changed from the time when we were actually concentrating, I mean really concentrating on getting rid of the meth labs and some of those kinds of activities. And so from that, it changed a bit until where you started having, because our laws didn't allow for some of the products so easily to get. And so from that, then it became transporting in up the highway from outside. So can you talk a little bit about really and looking at the whole drug piece of where we are today in Oregon? We're not in the same place that we were a few years ago when the concentrating was on the manufacturing of mom and pops and methamphetamine.
Senator Winters, members of the committee, that's correct, that the manufacturing has... it's not the same issue in terms of methamphetamine, but methamphetamine still remains the biggest threat to Oregonians in terms of drugs, followed by heroin and prescription drugs also remain threats. I can tell you that it's not, and I'm going to get to this in another slide, it's not been released yet, but the HIDA is releasing its annual threat assessment that really goes through all of the threats facing Oregonians in terms of drugs. And so that's a great resource. I don't know all the details of it here, but that's definitely something that I will get in your hands when that's published.
I think it's important because not only do we need to know how the threat has changed in Oregon, but that the utilization of some of those issues are still the same or even greater than they were. And, so from the law enforcement perspective, but also this body also has the task of looking at, treatment modalities and some of those other pieces. It's more than just the law enforcement piece, but it's also the recovery and the treatment and some of those pieces. So I think we would welcome when that report comes out to see what the magnitude of the drug impacts are in Oregon.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, I wholeheartedly agree. I think that it'll be a very useful resource. Which brings me to the second part of this is exactly what you're talking about, is we have one HIDTA-funded analyst who does strategic analysis. And so we have the HIDTA threat assessments, which is what I was just mentioning, which is due to be released shortly, is the annual threat assessment, which identifies exactly what you're talking about. What are the trafficking trends? What are the data down to drug pricing, which is more law enforcement function, obviously, but gives helpful information, and it's designed to be useful to those who are policymakers.
Will it also get into, even though we have legalized recreational marijuana and have, you know, medical marijuana, but I understand that even though we have that, we still have some issues that have to do with grow of marijuana that's still in Oregon. Will it get into some of those assessments and threats as well?
Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, yes, it does address medical marijuana and recreational marijuana.
And growing?
Yes.
Thank you.
Also included this year, what will be released is the HIDTA annual report. So there are 11 HIDTA counties that are funded through the HIDTA program in Oregon. There's one tribe, the Warm Springs Tribe, is funded, and there's two Idaho counties. And so this annual report is basically an assessment of the performance of those initiatives. And the HIDTA program also funds five HIDTA analysts that do tactical analysis. So this is kind of what we was talking about before with informational charge, the demonstratives, that kind of work. There's two of our analysts are co-located with the DEA, provide investigative support to the HIDTA counties, focus on drug trafficking and money laundering. So in addition, to the drug trafficking, there's other associated crimes, money laundering being the main crime, which is what the National Guard, we have two National Guard analysts, and that's what they focus on, is the money laundering side of trafficking, and develop leads from what information they can garner from the banking industry. The
with so much cash out there now, how do they?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee.
Since you can't bank?
But
what challenges does that provide for you?
Well, Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, it presents its own challenge to the extent it's harder to identify if it's not in the banking system. But I would not say that money that is generated from illicit activities does make its way into the banks, which the banks, and under federal law, when they have suspicions of the source of that money, do report it, and that can help generate leads for law enforcement. So another key component of this, just like within the Fusion Center, is training. We reach out to other analysts across the state, law enforcement officers, and help them. How do you investigate drug trafficking organizations? How do you disrupt and dismantle those organizations? And I have on my last slide just an example for you, again, of kind of what a link chart looks like. So, obviously, if somebody who has a lot of corporations or other businesses associated with that person, that's some evidence kind of want to maybe take a closer look what the legitimate need might be for that. So this is use of a shell businesses in a criminal racketeering investigation. And you can see they get quite complex.
My peepers don't do good on that chart.
Yeah. So this is the kind of work that they will do to help identify it. And this is what I should say. This is the kind of stuff you see in movies. It's in the back of the, behind the scenes. This is not something you'd want to present to a jury necessarily. That would be a little bit challenging to follow, but this is kind of the work they do to help develop the investigation. So I'm happy to answer any additional questions if the committee has any.
Thank you. Mr. Wolf.
Co-Chair Winters.
Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Steve Wolf. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Department of Justice's General Counsel Division, and I'm here to spend a few minutes talking to you a little bit about the manner in which the Department of Justice and General Counsel in particular performs contract review, what we do, how it works, some of the volume of the things that we do. With regard to contract review is one of the three major forms of work that we do in General Counsel, in addition to our general advice function and our representation of agencies in contested case hearings. And contract review has two components to it. One is, as part of our ordinary advice function, we can advise agencies on state contracts. But there's a second component, the mandatory legal sufficiency review, which actually constitutes the vast bulk of the contract work that we do. Ordinarily, agencies' use of general counsel services is elective, and that's true for much of the contract work. The legal sufficiency review is a little different for us in that it is mandatory. And so I'm going to focus in this presentation on that mandatory legal sufficiency review. The legislature enacted the statutes, which are now ORS 291.045 and 047, in 1997. And that so we're celebrating our 20th anniversary of doing contract legal sufficiency review. The ORS 291.049, which provides for ratification of contracts, and I'll talk a little bit about that process in a few minutes, was enacted 2 years later. Those statutes gave the Attorney General the authority to implement rules that defined what the legal sufficiency review would entail, what exceptions there might be to it, what legal sufficiency review does not entail. The impact of contract legal sufficiency review is that ordinarily, if a contract is subject to legal sufficiency review, it is not binding on the state, nor may a state agency make payments on the contract until it has been approved by the Attorney General for legal sufficiency. In General Counsel Division, we have a business transactions section, which does the bulk of our contract work, 17 attorneys and 3 staff. In addition to those, other attorneys in the division and a few other attorneys in the department are authorized to perform legal sufficiency review of contract. In order to be authorized to do that within the department, an attorney does have to undergo certain specified training so that they can perform that function reliably. Contract legal sufficiency review includes a number of things that you would anticipate. One, do you have the essential elements of a binding contract? Has there been an offer and acceptance? Is there consideration in the contract? Do you have legally capable contracting parties? Does it comply with federal and state law? And with state law in particular, you know, we're looking at, does the agency have the authority to enter into this kind of contract? Does it violate any of the Oregon constitutional limitations? And there we're looking primarily at the debt limitation provision and also the restraints on agencies possessing or owning stock in companies. Is the statement of work sufficiently clear and definite? And that's probably the bulk of the legal sufficiency review. Are you identifying the kinds of products, the kinds of services, the manner in which they are going to be delivered to the state in a way that is sufficient that we have enforceable rights and remedies? And then termination rights and remedies provisions are also part of our review. Do you have a legally adequate way of terminating the contract for non-performance or for at will, should the agency for some reason or other determine it doesn't want to go forward with it? Have you set up rights and remedies so that the other side is in breach, the state can pursue those remedies?
Question, Mr. Wolf. Looking at the knowledge of agencies or not, do you provide them, agencies, with this particular kind of outline so that they know when they're negotiating or talking to an entity before they actually submit the contract to you, or when it comes through DAS or whomever, it gets through that hands before you receive it, so that generally some of those issues, compliance with federal and state law, that some of those have been looked at before the AG begins to do its scrutiny.
Senator Winters, you anticipate something I was going to talk about anyway, so I'll do that now.
Shame on me.
I appreciate that. One of the things that we try to do is, talked earlier about the public law conference, and that includes a large block of training for agencies on contracting issues, including the legal sufficiency review components. We publish a public contracting manual, which we're in the process now of updating. In the enactment of HB 2375 2 years ago, included a requirement that DOJ develop in coordination with DAS a training program for agency personnel who are going to be involved in the contracting work. And so we're working with them. That's supposed to go online effective the end of 2018. And so we continue to work on that. And we also look at other ways that we can disseminate that information to our agency clients.
I raise this issue because if there's one complaint that I get, it's usually, quote, it takes too much time for us to get our contract through because it's held up in DOJ. Or they're coming back with this that we knew nothing about. Or, and so I think this is excellent, that requirement through DAS that agency personnel be trained ahead of time. I think that that will help facilitate things quite a bit.
Well, thank you, Senator Winters. And we also think that that's extraordinarily important. What we see both within DOJ but in the larger state enterprise is, you know, a lot of people who knew a lot about contracting and many other things in state government have moved on. Newer people are coming in, have not had the sort of steeped in the culture of state government and state law. And we grapple with that both internally but also with regard to our agency clients and trying to figure out how best to provide them the tools that they can use to effectively engage us and to comply with their missions. And so that's an important part of the General Counsel mission.
Is DAS also going to have, you know, individuals in their particular organization that also receive this training because they're usually the first point of contact?
Senator Winters, I believe that they are subject to those requirements.
Thank you.
And I know that they send a lot of folks to the public law conference as well. So we're looking forward to that.
I see Art back there.
A few of the things that legal sufficiency review does not include are consideration of facts or circumstances not apparent on the face of the contract. The attorney knows what's in the contract, not what is hidden in the head of a state officer. We don't opine on whether it's a good business deal for the state. It's up for this to the agency to make the business risk decision based on the advice that we provide them. You know, whether any particular remedy will be available is something we can't necessarily anticipate. So an agency might want to pursue something like specific enforcement, which is requiring that the contracting entity perform the contract rather than pursue remedies. That may or may not be available under the circumstances. We do not do stylistic or grammar review for the most part. Sometimes, as lawyers, we can't resist some dipping into that. But we try to avoid that. And I would say that although those are not part of the mandatory legal sufficiency review function, they are services that we can provide on request to the agency if they want it. That's part of our overall advice functions. You know, I mentioned that we had the two components of our work, which is the regular general contract advice function and legal sufficiency review. Actually, the extent to which we do contract advice that is not associated with legal sufficiency review is minuscule. It's dwarfed by we probably had fewer than 100 instances over the biennium where agencies seek out contract advice on contracts that they aren't required to come to us with. This slide shows the trends over the last two biennia in terms of the number of contracts that come to us for legal sufficiency review. This was for the entire 13-15 biennium and effective through March 8th of this year. While in the entire, and I'll have some updated numbers on a couple of these on the next slide, this is to show one, the general trends, which is that we were running ahead of the last biennium in terms of some of the numbers of contracts and amendments we were receiving. Amendments are important because they are subject to legal sufficiency review. If a contract was may originally not have been subject to legal sufficiency review because it was below the threshold amount that an agency needs to bring it to us for. If an amendment kicks it over that amount, then they have to come to us for legal sufficiency review before that amendment can be effective. Or if a contract was originally subject to legal sufficiency review, if it is amended, the amendment has to be brought to us. So as this slide shows, in 13-15, we had over 3,800 original contracts come to us. We had over 2,300 amendments come to us. So all of those contracts are being reviewed by, you know, the 17 attorneys and handful of other attorneys that handle these things within the department. Now, a lot of these are very simple. Some of them are extraordinarily complex. The kinds of contracts, this is just to show the sort of assortment, the bulk of, at least the largest number of contracts we see are personal services contracts. A lot of agencies contract with people to perform various kinds of services. Grant agreements are a big part of what we do, both where an agency is a grantee or where it's a grantor or where it's passing through certain kinds of grants. We see a lot of cooperative agreements between and among agencies of government, at the state cooperating with local governments and that sort of thing. So just a wide variety of things. And we have specialists in most of these areas. Real property, we have a group of specialists who handle those. IT, we have some specialized attorneys to do those. And so that's the way work makes its way through our business transactions unit.
Some contracts will require a lot more time than others. But on average, what is your turnaround time?
Senator Winters, well, we have our KPM on that is we're targeting 5 days for the first substantive response. We don't have good data currently on just the average total time, and that's something we're really working on. We have purchased and as a department are implementing a new set of legal tools which will give us a much greater flexibility in terms of matter tracking and data collection than we've had in the past. We've sort of been, like a lot of agencies, anchored with a legacy systems that were coded back in the 70s and held together with spit and baling wire for a number of years, and which don't play well with one another. So our timekeeping system doesn't work well with our matter tracking system, neither of which works well with our document management system. But we're going to have an integrated suite, and we're looking forward to being able to develop these metrics and collect data that will allow us to understand where we do have bottlenecks. I think, you know, there are reasons for some of the times where things do take time, but we have to face up to the fact that sometimes, yeah, things just get stuck for one reason or another. We need to figure out where those things are and how to move them along.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to make certain that there was a distinction between the bottleneck that happened at DAS versus the bottleneck that happens at DOJ. Because, you know, often when we get the finger pointing, it's kind of like this. And so I know that we've had some conversation, and so maybe DAS's KPM is here, and they've got a time there and before it comes to you, because often what we hear sometimes is that you get the blame for things that you did not do. I'm just putting that out there on the record.
Well, thank you, Senator Winters. I will not comment further on that, but I think it's a very interesting observation. So thank you for that. I mentioned that these.
That was doing my own due diligence and trying to figure out where it was. So,
thank you. We do deeply appreciate that and your interest. As I mentioned, these were the numbers through March 8th. We had some updated numbers through May 10th. We weren't able, didn't have the opportunity to break them down in the way that we did the earlier numbers. But just want to show you that, again, those gross numbers for total contracts that we're receiving and processing are high. And we're seeing a lot of contracts that, again, IT is very important. We are sort of in the midst of the time in the biennium where agencies are trying to spend a lot of money, and so we're getting a lot of contracts to review, a late session surge, and so those things contribute to, you know, our need to be as efficient as we can to move these things along.
So are we beginning to emulate the federal system? Never mind, don't answer that.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I will not answer that. I wanted to point out, again, this is just an assortment of some of our larger agency clients in terms of the number of contracts that they have reviewed. DHS is not the single biggest. ODOT's probably in total bigger, but they have the single biggest program, and most of their contracts, and you see they've had a big jump from 2013 to the current biennium. Most of their contracts are personal services contracts. ODOT has a wide range of contracts, construction contracts, what have you. And this is the KPM. I want to talk about that. This, I think it was the 11-13 biennium, our KPM for first substantive response was reduced from 8, which we were always consistently shooting under, to 5 days. And we've tried to hold to that, I think. And we've gotten close, but haven't quite gotten under it. We'll continue to work on that. As I say, we've got some things to do to make that happen. Part of it is we hope that the client trainings that we'll be doing will help us to get better contracts to review. I will say one of the things we've seen, again, with the switchover in personnel in a lot of contracts agencies where you have new folks coming in, is that some of the raw material we get to review is not as good as it was when people who were well-practiced and well-schooled in doing these things were doing it. So that requires more work on our part to bring them into compliance with the legal sufficiency requirements. HB 2317, in addition to the training component, had the template component. So we are working with DAS to develop templates that agency clients can use to develop contracts. That's continuing, ongoing, and we're hoping that one of the things we hope to be able to do with our new legal tools is figure out the extent to which the use of those templates adds efficiencies to the process that we're charged with administering. I think those are the main comments I wanted to make about the process. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Representative
Huffman.
Try to
answer questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a legal question. I've done a lot of work in the building with Oregon Inc. and universities and tried to develop ideas where we could gain income from some contractual relationships with companies. Yeah, you know, with Oregon Inc., we do a lot of assistance for startup companies and whatnot. And so I had found out early on that we can't own stock in a company. What's the reason for that? And I did identify kind of some ways around that that we might be able to participate. But what is the, do you think from a legal mind, why can we not do that?
Well, Chair Winters, Representative Huffman, there's a specific constitutional, state constitutional prohibition on state agencies owning stock in private entities. And so that's the why what the origin of that is. It's of ancient origin, and I don't know why it's
back
there. Yes, okay. but that's the strictly legal reason that those arrangements can't be done.
Additional question?
I just one, Madam Chair, and it's not that, and it's I don't know, maybe the Attorney General would want to ask. It was just. My mind went to public records when you were talking about something. My mind got off on response time, and you had just mentioned KPMs and 5-day response in a KPM on contracts, and my mind went to public records, and I thought, I wonder if we should have KPMs for agencies on public records response times.
Chair Winters, Representative Huffman, I think that's strictly a policy call.
Mr. Wolf is very good.
Though again, an intriguing idea. So.
Well, one, I'm applauding you for the work that you're doing and with the template and also with the training, because I think that that's very critical. You know, recognizing not only the turnover that we have in state government, but to make certain that agencies are proficient before you actually receive the documents that you receive. I think it'll help facilitate this process. So I want to commend you on that work for one who often, you know, when I get the complaints and I'm trying to figure out, you know, okay, who's where, who's on first, who's on third, and who dropped the ball in between. Mm-hmm. So I really commend you on that work and doing it. I think that those who are waiting for the contracts to be signed will also thank you.
Well, Senator Winters, I want to thank you for your interest in these issues, and to thank you and Co-Chair Stark and the members of the committee for your kind attention today.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just need guidance for tomorrow. Aaron Knott and I were sitting here going back and forth wondering how we were going to manage the 3 o'clock hour tomorrow. Because we both need to testify on 481, 253, and the budget here. And they are all things Attorney General, and I don't know how they all got planted on one day in the 3 o'clock hour, but I may be in and out tomorrow, and I'm sure you want me to be.
Well, I think tomorrow, as you know, we'll have child support and some of the others to wrap up tomorrow. And I'm quite confident that you will be speedy at wherever you have to go to testify, and you will be in and out. And I will make certain that those who are listening and looking in know that you're just not ignoring us, that you actually have official business someplace else. But I do know that you make it happen. Do you have any else to share with us?
Chair Winters, we have about 5 minutes left. Oh. Aren't we going to 4:30?
Well, you can go to 5.
Are you going to 5?
Wait a minute.
I was just, Madam Co-Chair.
I'll defer to Art.
I was just going to mention that does conclude what we had planned for today. We do have more tomorrow, of course. We don't have really anything, any one piece that would easily fit into the last few minutes of this hearing session. So,
well, I didn't know if the Attorney General had anything that she wanted to leave us with before I adjourned. She may want to share some nice pearls of wisdom.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Winters and Stark and members of the committee. Really today, I'm just sitting back there proudly listening to the folks from my team testifying. But at any time, I hope you know that I'm happy to be asked the tough questions. The buck stops here and there. Boss actually was born with his last name, but he is Boss in many ways. And I'm really honored to get to work with him and with Art and with the other folks who have been testifying here today. But I hope you appreciate that our work is very, very important, that it is very broad in what we cover. And I want to thank you for the questions that you ask and for your attention, because you've asked really excellent questions today. You know, we want to be worthy of your time and attention. So if at any time, I actually have the same issue that Representative Huffman has tomorrow and have to be in a few different places, but I will check back in. And at any time, if you have anything you want to ask me directly, please feel free to do that. I loved some of your ideas, by the way, today. So we'll be definitely following up with them.
Good. Any other questions or comments? With that, I've got 2 minutes. No, we are adjourned.
She'd run the
table.
Thank you. All right.